Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Welcome to The Election Tricycle, a podcast where we check in on what's happening with elections in the US, the UK and in India and other parts of the world when we have the chance. I'm joined by Emily in DC.
Hello.
And we'll have Tom Hamilton a little later on the show. We're starting off this week first with just a bit of updates from things that are happening in the US. Plenty to jump into, but just a couple of updates from the US.
Yes, that's right. So as I teased last week, the State of the Union was last week. And the sort of top line is that Biden did a solid job. I think, you know, he needed to prove that he was competent and had a holistic vision and was a fighter. And I think he did all of that. I think the punditry pendulum swung in his favor after the speech. A couple things I wanted to flag. His Israel-Gaza section was not, I think he wanted to show that his policy was in line with the rest of his foreign policy vision of like human rights, democracy, liberalism, international order. And I think because there's still no ceasefire, because the U.S. is now building a port to get aid in, his more liberally or progressive-minded base will still not be pleased or satisfied with that. The other thing, which is relevant to what I really wanted to talk about today with you, Rohan, is that basically Republicans were agitating for Biden to say the name Laken Riley because she had been killed by an undocumented immigrant. I think this was a pretty cynical use of a young person's death. Obviously, the murder of any person is terrible, but to choose one person to try to make a point about immigrants more broadly when Americans have school shootings and when Americans have like a massive gun violence problem and this, that, and the other, I think is quite, is pretty rich. Biden yelled back, yes, she was killed by, he said, an illegal, which is a slur. That's like not how we refer to people here in the 21st century. And he was like, but you should help me fix the border. And basically, there's been this bill held up in Congress that would further tighten controls of the border and focuses on enforcement, which is to say that I think Democrats right now, the Democratic Party, is sort of going along with the Republican line on immigration, right? Which is that more enforcement is necessary. And I think, I guess the reason that this is concerning to me, you know, besides the right that every person in the world has to seek asylum, right? Like, despite the fact that it's counter to that, there are ramifications for those who are currently in the country, who were themselves undocumented or not, whose families were or not, when one speaks about the body politic in this way, right? Like, Trump's entire political project is based on the idea that some people are more entitled to Americanness than others, that some people are more deserving of political representation than others. And I think what we're going to continue to see in the United States is how language on immigration, really divisive language on immigration, pushing for what I do consider to be draconian policy, how that then reflects back on domestic politics. And I wanted to talk about this with you, Rohan, because there's a story from India that I think, you know, it's not one for one, but I think also reflects this. Can you sort of catch listeners up?
Yeah. On the face of it, we're almost talking about this from another point of view, which is the BJP-led government in 2019 brought in a law that seeks to do the opposite of some of these things, which is they are seeking to make it easier for people from some neighboring countries of India to enter, to not be treated as illegal migrants, and to get citizenship of India. But the catch there to what has been known as the Citizenship Act amendments is that they've picked very carefully which countries people are being referred to and who is coming in from those countries. So specifically, what this law that was passed in 2019 does is it decides that those who have come through from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh will not be treated as illegal migrants if they are Hindu, Sikh, Buddhist, Jain, Parsi, or Christian. The obvious missing religion there is Islam, although, you know, you could also count Judaism, Baha'i, people of the Baha'i faith, non-believers, and so on. But what's happening there is basically they've said everyone who's non-Muslim from Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Pakistan, these three big Muslim neighboring countries of India, are able to come in and not be treated as an illegal migrant and get an expedited route to citizenship in India. The BJP and Modi government's argument broadly here is that these are persecuted minorities in these land and India should be a home for persecuted minorities, which again may sound rather generous. But the key bit here is that for the first time, really speaking in Indian history, this would add a religious test to who gets to be an Indian citizen. And a fairly arbitrary one at that, because we have other neighboring countries, you know, India neighbors Myanmar, where the Rohingya minority is currently being persecuted. India neighbors Sri Lanka, where, for example, the Tamils in the north, who many of whom are Hindu, have been persecuted. But this legislation doesn't name either of those countries, for example, and chooses to target three or to specifically label three Muslim majority countries. And then say that only those who are non-Muslim from those countries, keeping aside, for example, Ahmadiyyas or Hazaras, who are Muslim minorities within Pakistan, for example, who are persecuted in those countries. So it appears to be a pro-immigration, pro-migrant generous act, but in doing so, it creates a test of religion to India's citizenship.
Yeah, it's my understanding that there's still another level to this, and please correct me if I'm wrong. So the India and the BJP has denied that this level is there. So I happened to be in Delhi from 2019 to 2020 when protests around this act were really, I mean, quite prevalent and pronounced. And one of the things that people were saying was, "You're doing this because when you enacted a register of citizens in Assam, many people did not were left off and did not have documentation that they would have needed to prove that they belonged. If you do this to the country as a whole, right, if you establish a nationwide registry of citizens, you're now saying that if you're, as long as you're not Muslim, it's okay, right? Like we'll say that you're a citizen, but if you're a Muslim, you'll have to scramble for paperwork that maybe you don't have and didn't think that you needed. And so it's not just about new immigrants, but that it's about people already in India proving that they're citizens of India and that they belong there.
Exactly. For context, for those who are not as familiar with India, possibly our largest source of migration is from the eastern side, which is from Bangladesh, folks looking for a better life in India and so on, but also many people with familial community connections, because again, remember, Bangladesh was, East Pakistan was partitioned from India, and the cultural ties between these spaces are deep and old. The immigration discourse in India tends to focus on Muslim Bangladeshi migrants. The Home Minister of India has even referred to them as termites, gnawing away at, you know, the Indian fabric. And so what's being done here is exactly that. As you mentioned, in 2019, when these rules or when this law was passed in Parliament, the government also went around promising a national register of citizens of the sort that had been carried out in the northeast Indian state of Assam. Now, when this was carried out in Assam, as would be the case in many countries in the world, attempting to get your entire population to prove their citizenship is a deeply fraught act. People lose documents, especially when it involves not just you yourself, but your parents, your grandparents. In a country like India, never mind in a more developed space, I would imagine it would be deeply complex for people across the land to be able to prove that they are indeed citizens of a place. And so, as you said, what was being promised was basically that we will do this to weed out these termites eating away at our country. But we'll do it in a way that will not get in the way of Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, Jains, Parsis, and Christians. This was important because when it was done in Assam, a staggering 1.9 million people were declared foreigners within the country, essentially stateless, because India doesn't have a pact with Bangladesh or any other country to say, okay, then, you know, these people will return. These are not folks who have just crossed a border in any sense. These are people who have been around, you know, most likely for generations in the country. And so essentially what these rules do is turn them into stateless actors. And what was being threatened was to do this at the large scale across India.
So, you know, you said that this law was passed, or this amendment to the law was passed in 2019, but it's being implemented now. The reason we're talking about it this week is that news just broke that the Modi government has now said, okay, now we're going to implement it. Why was it not implemented back then? And why is it being implemented now, mere weeks before an election?
As you mentioned, there were huge protests, really remarkable protests in 2019. For the first time in a long time, protests led by Muslim women in many parts of the country, folks speaking up on behalf of the secular nature of Indian society and the Indian constitution, widespread, you know, acts of popular civil disobedience in terms of squatting on public roads, occupying public spaces to make this argument that India should not get on this slippery slope to adding a religious test in its citizenship laws. And despite attempts to demonize, to suggest that these are terrorists, to turn these folks who are protesting into the other, the protests remained strong until the pandemic broke out in 2020, and lockdowns were enforced, and that gave the government an opportunity to clear these roads that were being occupied and so on. But the question was left hanging, and possibly because of the steep and strong nature of those protests, the government had passed the law, but did not notify the rules underlying the law. So it couldn't actually come into effect for the last 5 years, never really explaining why they were doing it. My guess would be that they were afraid again that a protest movement would break out that would, particularly given last year's plans to have the G20 in India and so on, that would shine a bad light on the government. And they've chosen to do it at this moment because the potential polarization in favor of Hindu versus Muslim politics will play out in their favor going into this election.
I remember back then a big phrase one heard from the party or supporters of the party or supporters of the law was traitor, but also anti-national, right? So if you were protesting this law, especially if you were Muslim, though not only, right? If you were like part of the intelligentsia, if you were a student, if you were out protesting, you were an anti-national. And I spoke to someone back then who said, look, like the whole point of this is that unless you are a person the party sees itself as speaking for, and unless you yourself are an adherent to the party, you're not seen as a true national, right? And the point of this is that you're not seen as a true citizen. I'm wondering if you're seeing that sort of rhetoric now. If memory serves, you had a BJP official saying, shoot the traitors. Like, it was really quite, it was violent. People were burned in their homes in Delhi during this time. Like, it was, I'm wondering if it's now as sort of openly nationalistic, the rhetoric around this and the campaign, or if it's like, let's get through this campaign and sort of with a wink and a nudge.
The context of the Indian subcontinent's history is obviously wound up particularly with that defining act of partition, with a section of the Muslim leadership choosing to say that the Muslim population of South Asia is a separate nation. And that is what leads to the carving out of Pakistan from what was then British India. The millions of Indian Muslims that remain behind, either because they could not go or in many, many cases choosing to live in what promised to be a secular democratic republic, have always been tagged with being potentially a fifth column, potentially being traitors, because some of their religious compatriots, you know, chose to go be part of this other national project. And so the Indian Muslim minority has always been accused of being traitorous, of being anti-national. Under the Modi government, that has been expanded to anyone, as you mentioned, anyone who questions Modi and his party, because how could, you know, this current government not speak on behalf of anyone who's a true Indian? Is it any less so? It's maybe there was a bit tamping down of some of the rhetoric from the very top over the last year again because of the big international scrutiny. Some of it has to do with the fact that the BJP finds itself on just a much stronger footing. They often tend to resort to that sort of rhetoric when they want to polarize the voters and to get the gains of that kind of rhetoric. But going into an electoral season, I mean, this has just been declared. The opposition and civil society that opposed this in 2019 has not yet had time to mobilize or figure out how to respond to this. I'd say it's a pretty good bet that we'll get lots of charged and violent rhetoric in the coming weeks as we move into the elections, even though the BJP seems to be on a very strong footing.
I guess why, this is sort of a silly question, but if they are on strong footing, well, I guess, okay, so there's a part of me that thinks, well, if you are on strong footing, then this is a time to actually expand your party and make it so that it's not so limited in who it can represent, right? But I guess, on the other hand, the appeal of the party thus far has been that it's limited in terms of who it can represent. So if you go to expand that, you're sort of kicking yourself out of your own game.
But you make an interesting point because there's a bunch of interesting things happening with the BJP's campaign. They've noticed this. One, of course, India is big and federal. So while, you know, they have that core base that expects things like this, the BJP is hoping to expand into parts of the country. So in this case, West Bengal, for example, which does have that large section of Bangladeshi origin, Hindus and Muslims.
And where it lost the most recent state elections, despite investing a lot in trying to win.
Exactly. Could be one of those spaces that is polarized. Now, there you have millions and millions of Hindus who were originally Bangladeshi or were born in what was then East Pakistan or Bangladesh, moved over around the time of Bangladesh's creation and afterwards in 1971, and who might feel reassured about their presence and beholden to the BJP because their citizenship is now certain, but this is not clear. There are observers who think that this tactic could backfire against them in places like West Bengal and Assam, where the politics tends to then become nativist and not religious, where, you know, native Assamese don't want outsiders to come in, whether it's Hindus or Muslims or folks from other. So it's unclear. I think that there are always fights to be had on the margins. The BJP wants to expand into certain spaces, but they've also used the last couple of years to reach out to minorities within minorities. Modi made a big deal last year of reaching out to lower caste or lower in the hierarchy Muslims, Pasmanda Muslims specifically. There's always been a close connection between the BJP and Shias or other, you know, Muslim minorities within India. And Modi has made a big show of reaching out to Muslim women by promising to get rid of things like triple talaq, which is an automatic divorce system that exists within Muslim personal law. So I think the answer is, you know, is twofold. One, the BJP does want to reiterate its own support. You know, it's going into a decade of incumbency and it wants to make sure its own base is fired up. And also maybe there are tacticians within the BJP that see gains from doing something like this in the margins of some of these states where we have this. I'm curious how, you know, one of the big things of Trump was the Muslim ban and how the Supreme Court reacted to that at the time. I'm assuming civil society today is, who in that vein, is mostly caught up with questions about Gaza and Israel. But, you know, are those questions of religious targeted minorities, is that something that is still showing up in the American discourse?
I think absolutely. I think, look, our Speaker of the House has been described, not unfairly, in my opinion, as a Christian nationalist, right, who thinks that the United States should be a Christian country. I think many Republicans, including Trump, have continued to make extremely Islamophobic rhetoric a key part of their campaign. There's also this dynamic in the U.S. where, in addition to that, the places that Trump contested the 2020 election results and where he said, no, there must be fraud, were all cities with large Black American populations, right? Which is to say, like, even if you are clearly a citizen, right, your family has been here for years and years and years, if you're not the right type of American, if you're not a white American, if you're not a Christian American, if you're not, but let's say in this case, it was really white American, then how could you possibly be fairly casting a vote, right? It's a very, and this is, I guess this is what I mean by like the language of immigration and otherness versus that of nativism. It's not just about immigration policy. It is, and that's important and that's real, but it also bleeds into everything else. Fundamentally, we are talking about who gets to participate in the demos, who gets to be a citizen, who's entitled to making their voice heard in our society. Like, that is fundamentally what this is about. Trump's entire political project is not just, you know, people talk about how he came down the escalator, the golden escalator, before announcing his first presidential run, and talked about building the wall, and talked about, said horrible things about Mexican people. And that's true. But like, to only look at that, I think, misses the larger picture, which is that it's not just about the people who are here versus the people who would come. It's about who is already here counts. And I think we're seeing that as well.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things I was attempting to follow from afar was the reactions to, you know, I mean, we don't have to talk about him too much, but Vivek Ramaswamy in attempting to play this part of the Republican field. But we would see these occasional pieces, especially from his partner, his wife, I can't remember, talking about the questions about being Hindu and being, you know, and running in on that side. I remember being in America when Obama was described as Muslim and Arab. And who was it that stood up and said, no, he's not an Arab. He's a good man.
Mm-hmm. That was John McCain.
John McCain, yes. Who was praised for this.
And at the time, that was hailed as like a nice thing to say, right? I think especially Islamophobia is still, and unfortunately in many ways, like an acceptable hatred to many in American politics. Really quickly, your point on Vivek is it's well taken, because Indian Americans overall are a quite liberal voting bloc in the United States. But it's sort of not dissimilar to American Jews, where the vast majority of us vote for Democrat, but you have these very prominent individuals who are quite conservative and who sort of promote their identity in a way, right? Like, but in a non-threatening, like, no, I'm right here with you, white Christian sort of way. I think what was interesting in his case is that it's like you're sort of denouncing your own family experience, first of all. And second of all, I think this was not an issue for him. I think this will be an issue for Indian Americans in the Republican Party going forward, who want to both stress their heritage and stress their family story, because increasingly Indians now make up the third largest group of undocumented immigrants in the United States per the Pew Center's 2021 estimates. And so you have a real demographic shift there between different representations of an immigrant or descendant of that immigrant population. And I do wonder how that will play for Indian American politicians who really want to play on a quite xenophobic line, but also stress their own successful, you know, all-American immigrant success story. We will leave our part here for now. We did want to hear from Tom on immigration and citizenship in the United Kingdom.
Hello, Tom here in London, and late for the main recording, which means that I couldn't take part in the conversation with Rohan and Emily about how immigration is playing out in their respective countries. One difference that really strikes me in the way that immigration plays out here compared to the way it plays out in the States is that it's really clear that at the moment in the States, immigration is a significant strength for Donald Trump and a weakness for Joe Biden, and that sort of apparent in how the campaign is playing out and how both sides want to legislate and not legislate. In the UK, it's very different, because although immigration is typically something that is a bigger concern on the right than the left, it's also something that, because the Conservatives have been in power for 14 years, it's quite a significant weakness for them now electorally, without being a massive strength for Labour. It's just something on which the Conservatives are not trusted, because they've performed very badly on immigration, if your test of immigration is controlling it and getting the numbers down. We've got record figures for net migration, which is to say the number of people coming into the country versus the number of people leaving the country. And so they just can't point to a successful track record, given that getting net migration down was something that they fought, actually, the 2010 election on. Apart from anything else, it was a major part of what people were concerned about during the Brexit vote, and it's something that they continue to talk about. At the same time, although Labour can talk about them failing on that metric, Labour isn't that comfortable with that metric, because it doesn't feel the need to keep migration down in quite the same way. So it gets challenged by the Tories for not having a plan. And those things sort of go together to mean that immigration isn't something that Labour massively wants to raise, but it's something that the Tories think they have to raise, and that it probably does them more harm than good when they do, because of the nature of their overall performance. One of the things that Labour picked up last week in the budget is that, according to the Office for Budget Responsibility, which is an independent body that assesses whether any government's budget plans add up, is that the only reason that the economy in the UK is set to grow over the next few years is because of a relatively high level of immigration. That is what the economic success is based on. But that's not something that the Tories are going to talk about. And even Labour has to be careful about how it talks about that, because it doesn't want to say that that's bad, but it also doesn't want to say that it's good, because we have a country that has, you know, as all countries do, slightly ambivalent attitudes towards migration. One of Rishi Sunak's key pledges in the new year, shortly after he, in last new year, I should say, shortly after he became Prime Minister, one of the five things he said he was going to do was to stop the boats. And by stop the boats, the Tories mean a particular relatively small element of immigration, which is asylum seekers who come over across the English Channel from France in small boats. And there's two major issues about that. One is that they are asylum seekers who, in general, the government wants to reduce the number of asylum seekers. And one is that there is a purely humanitarian concern about the fact that these boats are extremely unsafe. People do die making the crossing. It is not how anyone would want people to be entering the country. And so you can make a stop the boats case from both left and right in different ways. But the issue with the Tory pledge to stop the boats is that they have absolutely not done so. And the only thing that ever does stop the boats is bad weather. Which, you know, in the UK, that happens quite a lot, but not enough for any government to really claim credit for it. The main policy that the government has been trying to put in place to deal with the boats is a pledge to send some asylum seekers, a relatively small number of asylum seekers, to Rwanda, a country in Africa which has been paid a significant amount of money by the UK government to say that it's prepared to process some asylum seekers who come to the UK, are flown to Rwanda and are then processed and either granted asylum or not granted asylum there. It's not that they are processing asylum claimants on behalf of the UK. It's that they are getting asylum claimants, processing them, and then deciding whether to grant them asylum in Rwanda or not. So the UK doesn't have a direct role in the asylum claim. There are all sorts of legal challenges to this. And as a result of that, nobody has yet been flown to Rwanda. One of the things that Labour likes to say is that more Home Secretaries have visited Rwanda than asylum seekers, which is true as it stands, although we've had quite a lot of Home Secretaries in the last few years, one of whom lasted less than a week, in fact. But one of the big tests of the Tories between now and the election is whether they can get anybody on a plane to Rwanda or not. There's legislation going through Parliament at the moment, and there's a decent chance that they won't. You might remember I mentioned on this podcast a few weeks ago that Rishi Sunak slightly distastefully made a bet with Piers Morgan on TV of £1,000 of whether anyone would end up flying to Rwanda before the election. And it remains to be seen which way that bet will go. Labour have said that they will not go ahead with that plan. The Tories have tried to use that as evidence that they are weak on asylum. I'm not convinced that that lands particularly well, because the difference between the Tories and Labour on Rwanda is that, you know, neither of them are going to send anyone to Rwanda, but the Tories want to and Labour don't, which isn't a massively effective dividing line. But Labour has its own issues on immigration as well, because basically it is temperamentally not in favour of particularly draconian measures. It has a record in government of having been actually quite draconian around asylum, although relatively relaxed about economic migration. One of the big drivers behind the Brexit vote was that a lot of people perceived that significant amounts of economic migrants were coming in from the EU, and that the government was unable to stop them because of EU membership. And it was Labour that was at the root of the decision to change, when the EU expanded, there were many more people who were able to come into the country from parts of Europe that hadn't previously been part of the EU. When I worked for the Labour Party a while back in 2015, one of the pledges that Ed Miliband stood on was to put controls on immigration, which famously got put on a mug that was sold in the Labour Party shop, very controversially. And Some people see it as a symbol of why Labour was too far to the right in those days. Other people see it as a symbol of the fact that Labour was in various ways inauthentic in those days. It was a classic fudge on the part of the Labour Party, which is which it often ends up with, where the controls on immigration that it wanted to put on were almost entirely around enforcing minimum wage law better, making sure that unscrupulous employers didn't mistreat immigrants and undercut domestic workers by paying them a lot less and treating them a lot worse. Tackling those things, they are controls on immigration, but they're not things that anyone thinks about when they talk about controls on immigration. So you ended up with Labour alienating voters on the left who thought they were being draconian, and alienating voters who were a bit more right-wing who thought that, come off it, these controls on immigration are not controls on immigration. So it is not uncommon for Labour to please nobody. And that's certainly what happened in that era. But now we're at a time when the people who aren't pleasing anyone on migration are basically the Tories. And although I don't expect it to be a centrepiece of Labour's election campaign, it is a bit of a problem for the Tories because their failure to deal with an issue that is being particularly pushed as an issue by the right, by the media on the right, both sort of both GB News, the new right-wing TV station, and various right-wing papers, has a big impact on how Conservative MPs think that they need to deal with migration, has a big impact on how the government behaves. And as it turns out, they've not been able to do very much about it.
Okay. That is all for our regular listeners. Thank you so much for being with us. Premium listeners, stick around. We have our listener question and our potted profile right after this. Regular listeners, thank you so much. Please like, subscribe, tell a friend, and join us next week.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.